Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. I'm delighted to have back as my guest for the second time, Jeffrey Deaver. And first of all, Jeff, thanks so much for taking time out to speak with us again today.
Oh, Casey, I'm delighted, as always.
The Sleeping Doll is the new release. So we will mention that Cold Moon is now available in paperback.
Yes, that's
right. Which was the Lincoln Rhyme novel, which introduced Catherine Dance.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
And last year, I remember when we talked, one of the first things I said to you was that I really liked the character Catherine Dance. And you mentioned at the time that it was in Galleys that the feedback you were getting was that she was turning out to be a very popular character.
Indeed, yes.
So what was the genesis? Did you know at the time, Jeff, that you were just going to write a novel featuring her?
Actually, Casey, the concept occurred, as I may have mentioned last year, while I was in the process of planning out The Cold Moon, I listened to what my fans say. To me, fans are gods. Mm-hmm. Anytime I hear an author say, "I write for myself," my initial reaction is, "No, you don't."
Right.
You write for your audience. And I've been aware of my emails, and I read almost all of them, try to answer all that are fairly reasonable.
Yeah.
Do get some wackos occasionally, but
sure.
Try to answer all of them. And many fans, as much as they love Lincoln Rhyme and love the really fast-paced technical books, are always asking me about the lives of the characters, what their relationships are like. Had I ever considered writing a bit more of a character-driven story, while, of course, not sacrificing my twists and turns? And I thought, well, you know, here's a good opportunity to try that. I can't really do it with a Lincoln Rhyme book. We certainly know about Lincoln. We know about Amelia and the other characters. But they are, you know, essentially forensic novels, very technical. And I thought, well, I'm gonna create a new character, someone who is more psychologically oriented, someone who is... has a skill other than forensic science, and sort of like happens on a sitcom, I'm going to introduce her in a Lincoln Rhyme book and then spin her off if she seems popular, and that's exactly what happened. I mean, we could say I'm rather calculating and manipulative about it, but I don't care. If it makes my fans happy, that's all I care about.
Absolutely. And Catherine Dance is an expert in, is it kinesics or kinesics?
It can be pronounced either way. I say kinesics, but that's probably my Midwest upbringing.
Well, same here. So why don't you define for listeners kinesics, and also there's a very good book, Principles of Kinesic Interview and Interrogation by, I believe it's Stan Walters.
Yes.
And if you would, just tell the listeners what kinesics involves.
Sure. It's a coined term. It comes from the word kinetic, meaning motion. And kinesics was a phrase that was developed by a man in the 1950s, and it refers to body language. Simple as that. And all of the psychological implications of analyzing someone based on how he or she moves, sits, mannerisms, gestures, speech patterns. It's less concerned with the content of what people say rather than how they say it. Do they pause? Does their voice go up in pitch or down in pitch? Do they speak quickly at a certain point? When they're speaking, do they touch their ear? Do they scratch their head? Do they sit back? Do they sit forward? And this is it has truly risen to the level of a science. This is not alchemy or witchcraft by any means. And as I've been talking to people about the books, people say, well, okay, you can sit down, say you're on a date, Jeff, and you turn to the girl and you see that she's sitting forward or sitting back or has her legs crossed or is, you know, leaning away from you. What does that mean? Well, in fact, a police officer would rarely make any deductions based on a one-time observation. To be a truly effective practitioner of analyzing someone through body language takes considerable time, several interviews. Certainly you can get some very good ideas, about whether they're telling the truth or whether they're hiding something. But it's a you know, it's actually a rather scientific process, and one I have to say I'm quite fascinated with.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And Catherine, one of the things that she's very good at is establishing the baseline that you're talking about. And
exactly.
I like the way she begins her interviews, asking questions that she knows they're going to answer accurately. And then she'll do things like even just change the glasses she's wearing or something.
Right.
Very subtle.
Exactly.
Thing.
Well, I know that I happen to be in the D.C. area at the moment, and I have friends who are in the national security community. And occasionally I'll be put down as a reference for someone, and a FBI agent or a federal investigator will come to ask me what I know about this person. And, you know, I know they're absolutely nothing to hide. I can give them glowing reviews. But, you know, someone comes to you and flashes a badge, and you feel a little nervous. Your behavior is a bit different. But then after, you know, a half hour, you relax, and then you establish a form of behavior that they can measure against future comments, just
sure.
to make sure you're telling the truth.
Sure. And there are some we obviously won't give any plot elements away, but
always one of the difficult things about my books, because I even The Sleeping Doll, I was talking about it being character-driven, it nonetheless has about three surprise endings, as mine
yeah.
typically do.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, when I thought I was done, yeah, I wasn't done. But on page 8, you have that mirrors are placed in interrogation rooms because people are less inclined to lie when they can see themselves.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I found that very interesting.
Yeah, we have the idea that, the criminal is not going to figure out that there's a camera behind that one-way mirror. Anybody who's seen, you know, The Wire or Hill Street Blues or any number of cop shows or Clint Eastwood movies, you know, of course there's a camera behind there or witnesses, but that's not going to fool the criminal. But if someone is aware of themselves, even if they're not looking at themselves, but they're just aware that they are reflected, they have their image nearby, it does affect them psychologically.
Mm-hmm. And I think that if you talk to a lot of people, my wife included, they think they're very good at spotting liars. And on page 67, you mentioned that two clues signal lying. One's a very slight increase in the pitch of the voice. The other is pausing before and during answering.
Uh-huh.
And so you get very specific in some of the interviews and some of the interpretation of the kinesics. And I found that a lot of the things that I thought would be true are not true.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's there are a lot of I coined a term, old cop tales, as in old wives' tales, about it's essentially what it comes down to black magic. For instance, if someone avoids eye contact, that means they're lying. If they look to the left when they walk into the room, that means they're lying. Well, this has no basis in reality at all. What you have to do is sit down, establish that baseline of the with the person, and then look for very subtle deviations. But now, it is true, if you were meeting someone for the first time and the individual was garrulous, was carrying on a conversation, and then you asked a question and the person suddenly paused several times, there would be a reasonable inference that they were pausing not to refresh their memory, but they were pausing because they were making stuff up.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a reasonable subject that you as an interrogator might want to go back and revisit at some point.
Mm-hmm. And I think with kinesics, one of the things that I like that you dealt with in The Sleeping Doll is Catherine Dance's Salvation is Music.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lyrical feature to this kinesics that Catherine is very well tuned into. And I love the sections of the book where you introduce us to some of the music that she listens to.
One of the fascinating things about her, and as I think you mentioned, this will be a series. I've already got a book planned out, that her music is going to get into a lot of trouble. She is what's known as an amateur song catcher. these are individuals who travel around the country and record songs, not for profit, but simply to collect Native American music, Hispanic American music, any number of things, mountain music, very, very popular in the 1950s. Alan Lomax traveled around the country for the Library of Congress, simply recording these so that there would be an archive of traditional music. Well, this is something that fascinates Catherine, the interplay between culture and songs and music. And so I've got a book all outlined where she's going to go out on the countryside and get into a lot of trouble. I can be really mean to my protagonists.
Well, you've got one that's in bed, so you can't do much with him. So,
No. I almost set fire to him once, I have to say. I mean, he couldn't even go for a fire extinguisher. I felt guilty about that. But yeah. Obviously, we've got the new book out, so we know he survived.
Right. Jeff, one of the things that there's a character, Jenny, who I found very interesting, and the phenomena of particularly women that write to convicts. Mm-hmm. Plays Daniel Pell is one of the protagonists in the novel, and I think there's a lot more of this that goes on than probably the average person is aware of. And when you were doing your homework on that, this is a fairly common occurrence, isn't it?
Well, in fact, Casey, that was not going to be in the book originally. In other words, the fact that she was a bad boy worshiper, I guess we could say, I'd intended to include in the book at some point. Maybe he would meet her, and we should, for your listeners, Daniel Pell's my bad guy, and he has this sort of charismatic, evil, demonic personality that captivates the vulnerable and some not-so-vulnerable people. And Jenny becomes his sidekick, both willing and unwilling. And it never occurred to me that she should meet him in prison. And yet, that happens with some frequency. In fact, people have fallen in love with lifers, with prisoners who are doing time for the rest of their lives, and they get married.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my idea of a perfect relationship, but maybe it works for them. But it is more common than we would think.
Yes, and Daniel Pell is the beginning of the book. He's referred to as the son of Manson, and I thought another of the themes that I enjoyed was just this desperate longing people have to belong to a family, to have a connection to a group, because we've become an increasingly isolated society. And people like Daniel Pell know how to kind of spot people in crowds.
I don't write anything more than what I think, I hope, is a fast-paced adventure story, and I don't get up on my soapbox, and I don't have any political or psychological insights that are going to help solve the world's problems. But if this book is about anything other than catching the bad guy, it's really about families. And today's families, and how desperate we are, and what gaps are in our family lives, and how those gaps can be filled by any number of things, and when they're filled by someone who's exploitative, whether we knew them before or not, it can be quite a dangerous situation.
Mm-hmm. And Jeff, what percentage of your readers would you guess are women? Because I think female readers are going to particularly enjoy The Sleeping Doll, because Catherine Dance has to balance her life with her children, her demands, and I guess not what percentage, but I think that this is a book that a lot of women are going to read and enjoy because...
I study my demographics. I consider myself a manufacturer and marketer of a product, and the majority of readers of suspense fiction in America, I'd say in America, in the United Kingdom as well, where I go quite a bit, are women. 60%, maybe a little more than that. Men, of course, prefer, and this is not a gender-centric thing to say, it's just the facts, prefer more techno books, the Tom Clancy, the Shoot 'em Up, the Army kind of thing, a little less psychological insight. And I know my market, and I gear the gear this book to that audience. And I'm often asked, how do you write about women? And it's just a challenge a writer has to stand up to. I wrote a book a few years ago called The 12th Card, about a young African American girl in Harlem. That was a challenge for me to write from her point of view authentically. Writing about a widow, Catherine lost her husband a few years ago, who is the mother of two children, in their preteens, just about to become teenagers. And that was a bit of a challenge to me, but I like to think I pulled it off.
Yes, you did. And the balance, that balancing act that she does in her case is particularly demanding, because she is in, she and her family are can get in harm's way very, very easily. So I could see how you could be very interested in her as a series character, because her life is very complex.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I've got storylines I've actually introduced in this book that will play out in future books. There are a few unresolved issues.
Yes.
We don't want to go into those at this point.
But, right.
Things that that will be looked at in the future.
Good. One of the things that the comments that that you make in the Sleeping Doll, which is published by Simon & Schuster, is that withholding information is the hardest type of deception to detect. And that seems like an obvious statement when, you know, at face value. But as I was reading the Sleeping Doll, I realized that, and again, I think I know where some of the plot lines are going, so I'm not going to mention it. But that really is a difficult thing. If that is the toughest thing. If someone is very good at what they do, by not telling you something, that is very, very hard to figure out.
Well, the whole essence of body language, kinesic, and interviewing and interrogation technique requires some affirmative action on the part of the subject. If they simply sit there and don't say anything and just stare at you or stare at the wall, it's pointless. You just may as well end the interview or keep coming back and trying again. You need them to say something. The most nefarious are the ones who tell you, first of all, what you may want to know or what you think you want to know, and give you half-truths, and then simply neglect to mention the most important parts of the puzzle that would allow you to bring it all together. So you think you have something, you think you've formed a relationship with this person, and yet the important, the crux of the truth behind whatever crime was committed or may be committed in the future is eluding you.
Mm-hmm. And the audience, your readers, I think one of the reasons that this is a golden age for I hate to say genre writers, but writers.
Well, I'm proudly a genre writer. Nope.
Yes.
At
yes.
All.
But I think that some of the best writing being done right now is in the genre field, and because I think it gives the readers, particularly in the world we live in right now, there's a sense of right and wrong and integrity with a character like Catherine Dance, which people desperately need. And there's again, we're not giving anything away, but there's towards the end of the book, there's a moment where I thought to myself that maybe Catherine was going to show some mercy, I think it's this integrity that is the key to the success of these type of novels. That
I believe in heroes. I think we like reading about heroes. We can throw in a bit of moral ambiguity from time to time, and my books are sometimes faulted in Europe more than in America, because the crime fiction there accepts more gave you a little bit more about the way the world really is. But I want my good guys to be good and my bad guys to be bad. And I'm not going to end in a very ambiguous way. We know where everybody stands at the end of the book. It's my definition of a story, for instance. I feel very strongly about this. It's characters that we know, that we may like or we may despise, but they're very realistic characters. And then I throw them in conflict, put them in a big pot, and turn the heat up as high as I can. But then at the end, I take them off the stove. We've got to resolve all those issues. And I think that's a very important element in my fiction. And it's faulted sometimes because that's not the way life really is. But hey, pick up the newspaper if you want to see the way life really is.
Right. No, thank you. And Jeff, you start the story on a Monday and it ends on a Saturday, and that creates the tension and the drama as well. And when you start a novel, you kind of like that day by day structure, don't you? Or do you use different styles to fit the need of the novel?
Well, this is actually one of my more leisurely books. A typical Lincoln Rhyme book will take place over about 48 hours. That really gets your palms sweating. I've made a conscious decision again to write something that was a bit more leisurely. Now, there's no padding in the book. It's not a short book, but everything that's in the story has to do with either the conflict of catching Daniel Pell, this villain, of the characters resolving conflicts that they've established between themselves, well, that I have established between them, trying to deal with the internal politics, which is always the case in law enforcement. So there's a lot of stuff happening and going on, but it is a little more leisurely than say, a Lincoln Rhyme book, and that, again, is some of the input from my fans. They'll pick up, for instance, The Cold Moon. I don't know how long it was, probably 420 pages, something like that. And I can't tell you how many letters I got saying, well, Jeff, you know, I read it in 2 days. Took place over about 2 days and read it in almost real time. And then it was over with, and I had to wait a year. Could you
write
something that maybe, you know, I can read at night and then pick up the next night and the next night? So
yes.
I think by introducing the issues of Catherine's home life, her relationships, because she has some ostensible relationships, personal relationships forming in this book. She's been a widow for 2 years, and she's thinking it's about time to get back in the dating game again, which causes all kinds of problems with her children, of course.
Yeah.
I appreciate your noting that, Casey, because it is a bit of a departure, and yet I think I still give my fans exactly what they want, but we have a little different tone than we do in the Lincoln Rhyme books. And I must say, too, if I may, I'm now writing the Lincoln Rhyme book for next year. It's about three-quarters of the way through, and I had to go back to that really fast-paced writing, and it took me a little bit to get adjusted to it. I had to pull some things out, because now we've got, again, about two and a half days to resolve the action.
I was wondering, I imagine it was probably good for you as a writer to have a little bit of a different pace to go at. It was probably nice to take a little vacation from that really intense pacing. And this is a book you can actually put a bookmark in. Some of yours, you're wasting your time putting a bookmark in.
Exactly. And I never would have done that if my fans hadn't said, not all of them, some
right.
absolutely love the Lincoln Rhyme book, and I hope they'll pick up The Sleeping Dowel. They won't be disappointed. They'll get a little bit of they'll hear a little bit from Lincoln Rhyme and Amelia in the book. They make a little cameo appearance, but people have said, let's look at these characters, and meanwhile, we've still got this psychotic killer roaming the Monterey Peninsula.
Sure, and you give a little tip of the hat to John Steinbeck, which we can never do too often. So.
Oh yeah, I spoke not too long ago at the Steinbeck Library, and it was just a very, very moving experience. About 400 people there, and I, of course, grew up reading him and have been going out to that. I have a little place out there in, near Monterey, so I have a lot of affection for the area.
Good. Jeff, so next is next will be Lincoln Rhyme,
right.
And then Catherine Dance after that.
Yeah, my plan, and I see no reason to deviate from this point. At this point, is to do one a year, alternate Lincoln, and then a Catherine, then a Lincoln, then a Catherine.
Oh, that's great.
That's another thing I learned from my fans. They really like series characters. I don't care myself writing what we call one-offs or
yes.
With the series. I get a kick out of writing books. Period. That's the benefit for me. But if the fans like characters, well, then we'll give them characters that they're familiar with.
Sure. And I think the last time last year when we spoke, you had some film work and some was it a TV project you were working on as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, that's still in the works, fortunately. Although I'm delighted to say that we've just wrapped a short. I say rap like I was involved in it. I sold them the
right.
short story, a story called The Weekender, that was in my first collection of short stories called Twisted, and an independent film company out in L.A. has just finished shooting that for a submission to Sundance and various film festivals, especially in Europe. So I'm excited about that, and may have some forthcoming future stars in it, who knows. But and meanwhile, some of the other projects are under option, and the scripts are being written, and then
sure.
rejected, and then accepted. So it's Hollywood. What can we say?
Right, exactly.
I think I need to write about a big green character with two horns coming out of his head. The Shrek Collector. Maybe I should write something like that.
Yeah, because Superman's, I think he's too busy, so.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Well, Jeff, it's always a pleasure getting caught up. And the thing I would really like to convey to listeners is that the Sleeping Doll is it's a fascinating novel because I'm 50 years old, and I remember the Manson years. I remember the families, and the three of the characters who Catherine reunites. I think each of us can relate to what's happened to them in their lives, or we can talk, or we can reflect back on some friends we knew who went in one of the three directions that these women went in. So it kind of gives us it kind of has a resonance of the 60s that I enjoyed as well. And I think
I'm a bit older than you, Casey, not too much, but of course that was an era that was quite formative in my life. And I'd always had in the back of my mind, the Manson thing is amazing, but you've got to do it right.
Yes.
I guess I call them plain vanilla psychopaths are really pretty boring.
Yes.
And Manson, as terribly evil as he was, well, I guess I'd say like Hitler, you know, very obvious, nothing subtle about him at all. I wanted to create an evil entity that had been able to create a Manson. I'm the devil, for instance. I want to create a truly evil individual. Here's what I would do, and that's who Daniel Pell turned out to be.
Yeah. Well, I think the Sleeping Doll is going to be a hit. I think I'm so glad that Catherine Dance is here to stay. I thought she would be, and so how about if we pencil in. Next year when the new Lincoln Rhyme comes out, we'll do it again. We'll get caught up with you. In the meantime, people can get The Sleeping Doll, Cold Moon in paper. And also, for people that are looking for something to space a little bit more, Twisted and More Twisted, your short stories are out there for people to buy that want to just at night read a short story before they go to sleep.
I've been all prepared for the holiday season. Now you can take all these books to the beach with you.
Exactly. Okay, Jeff, well, thanks again, and we'll get caught up with you next year.
Okay, take care, Casey. I always enjoy talking to you.